All right, so let's talk about this reading from Proverbs, shall we? The book of Proverbs is an anthology of anthologies. There are poems in it, and there are aphorisms, there are wise sayings taken from real life or real life of the ancient world. It's descriptive. In places, it's provocative. It's meant to be a guide for people in living wisely and well in their daily lives. In other words, it is human wisdom. It is not godly pronouncements. It's like, think of it as ancient world life hacks. Now, in all of the different genres of the book, there are these portraits of these idealized figures. Wisdom, for example, we heard her last week crying out from the street corners. Most of the book, however, paints a kind of conglomerate portrait of an idealized, wise male father figure. But in the very last verses of the book, yes, at the very, very end, read into that what you will, there is this portrait of a wise woman, a woman of strength, as she is called in Judaism, the capable wife. And just like her male counterpart, she is a rare find, a paragon of wisdom and virtue. And what we heard today was an ode praising her energy. She gets up while it's still dark and is busy providing food for her family and delegating tasks to her servants. We heard her praised for her economic talents. She's buying fields and planting vineyards, and she's spinning flax and wool and making her own garments, and not just for her and her family, but she's selling them too. And we heard about her personal virtues. She's strong, which we all know these days is the new thin. And she's smart, which we all know is the new sexy. And she's teaching kindness, and she's working for charities, and she has it all. A career and a family. She's the multitasking, multi-talented icon of female fecundity and power. And I know that it's an idealized portrait, but honestly, don't you sort of hate her? Just a little bit. I mean, here is yet another completely unrealistic, absolutely unattainable, undoubtedly written by a man, standard for women to try and fail to live up to. Now, of course, there are plenty of wise men, strong men, best of all possible men images for all of us guys to fail to live up to as well. But today, in light of all that's going on in our world, we have to ask, what do we do with this portrait? We could just say, well, that's just an idealized image. It's some ancient portrait with no relevance today, and forget about it. But the problem with that is that we are drowning in idealized images. There are thousands and thousands of perfect images for us to measure ourselves against. And I don't know about you, but every time I'm confronted with one of these perfect portraits and hear all of the amazing things that she is able to accomplish in a day, I just feel bad and small and inadequate and incapable. And compared to her, I am a total slacker dilettante. And if I sit with this uncomfortable feeling a bit longer, I realize that what's happening is I'm comparing myself to her. And not just to her, but this long, long line of idealized images. I compare myself to her and to him and to you and to all of the idealized images of other people and myself. In my head, all of the ways that I imagine myself to be, but I'm not. And as I continue to sit in this discomfort, I think, you know, of all of the things that we humans can be chemically or emotionally or habitually addicted to, comparison has got to be one of the most insidious. At least it feels like an addiction to me because I fall into comparison mode almost compulsively without even thinking about it. I compare myself to everything. Other leaders, other priests, other parents, other men, and I don't know anyone who doesn't do this. We compare ourselves to others in positive ways, arguing over who is the greatest, for example, and in negative ways. I'll never be as good as this capable wife. Comparison is just something we do, and it's something that causes us to think things like, thank goodness I'm not like them, and I wish I was more like them. It makes us say things to ourselves like, I should be more productive. I should work harder. I should be able to fill in the blank. Or I shouldn't be so fill in the blank, lazy, stupid, pitiful, whatever. I shouldn't feel so bad because others have it worse. I should. In the language of recovery, this is sometimes referred to as shoulding all over yourself. It's not helpful, but it's something that we all do. Now, there is a positive side and a negative side to all of this. It's true that I am better at certain things than I used to be because I've had these high standards impressed on me. I've had role models to aspire to. I've had good teachers to guide me, and I've worked hard. The light side of this constant comparison craving is that it can and does drive us to become more whole and achieve things that we never imagined were possible. The flip side of this is that I have also grossly overestimated my own abilities. I've gotten in way over my head, and I have caused pain to myself and others trying to be someone I'm not. The shadow side of this constant craving often emerges as what James today names as envy and selfish ambition. And the disciples are smack in the midst of this today, arguing over who is the greatest. And they're ashamed of it, you can tell, because when Jesus asks them about it, what were you arguing about, they get really sheepish, right? And what does Jesus do? It's fascinating. First, he reminds them of the core teaching that those who want to be first must be last of all and servant of all. Which is true of the capable wife, too, isn't it? She is super industrious, but it's all for the sake of others. It's not to enrich or aggrandize herself. But then Jesus does something totally unexpected and utterly brilliant. He takes a child and puts it among them and then takes it in his arms. Now, you have to forget for a moment everything that you know or think you know about children. Because the child in this visual parable is not an image that we like to think of as innocence and openness or even really vulnerability. The child in this case is the one who is totally invisible in that world, in this world. The child here is an icon of those who are absolutely unseen, unheard, the ones with no power, no authority, no rights of their own. The child in this instance is not just someone who's lower in status, but one who is barely considered a human being. When we get into this comparison storm, it's very easy to want to be like the capable wife and then feel bad that we can't. It's also very easy to forget about the invisible ones or feel good that we're not like them, because this compulsion to compare forces us to fall into black and white thinking. Good, bad, right, wrong, better, worse. But Jesus invites us into something else. Jesus invites us into something that both encompasses and transcends this two-sided thinking. Alongside all of the idealized images of the good that we have in our heads, Jesus puts this image of the person that we most want to overlook, the one that we don't want to see, the one we can't imagine being like. And these two images, the exemplary human and the invisible human, are like two poles on a spectrum. And Jesus' invitation is to be like both of them. Jesus never says, don't emulate people like the capable wife, but he also makes it impossible for us to ignore those on the margins, the outsiders, the overlooked. We need positive aspirational images like the capable wife. We also need to hear and see and be like those on the margins, those outside of our own bubble. It's almost as if, by placing this child in our midst, Jesus is inviting us to stretch out in both directions, to strive to embrace both the idealized wife and the invisible child, to expand our reach, not out of comparison or envy, but out of compassion and with energy. And if we continue to do that and continue to reach out in both directions, we will discover eventually that we are indeed living a cross-shaped life.